He came eating and drinking. A look inside the meals of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke.
If you're new, we are in a series in the Gospel according to Luke called Eating and Drinking. And here's the reason we're doing this. Luke's Gospel is the longest account of Jesus' life and work as recorded in the Bible. And in Luke's Gospel, one of the things that Jesus is doing a lot or talking about a lot is eating and drinking. So much so that his entire ministry is sort of categorized as one of eating and drinking. So if you ask Jesus, how are you going to bring the truths of the kingdom of God? Well, he does it by eating and drinking. That's his method of doing ministry. And so we're looking at the stories of Jesus doing that very thing. Right? In the Gospel of Luke, there are 17 stories in 24 chapters of Jesus sitting at a meal, talking about a meal, teaching lessons from a meal, going to a meal, coming from a meal. I mean, Jesus is all about doing life with people. And so we thought it would be fun to unpack what are some lessons we could learn from some of those meals. Last week, we saw how Jesus used eating and drinking to assure forgiveness and to receive elaborate praise. That's what he did. That's what we looked at last week. Since that happened in the Bible, some events have taken place to bring you to the story that we're in today. Luke introduces us to women who are involved and invited in Jesus' ministry. And they're, it gives them names, and they are full participants of the mission of God and what Jesus is doing. Their primary role, according to Luke, is that they're funding the trips. So I think it's the ladies who are sort of paying for all of this dining that Jesus is engaging in, right? But nevertheless, they have an exceedingly important role in the ministry of Jesus, and Jesus lifts them up and he says, we value women. We do not push them down. We show them the worth that they have. We show them how they can participate. And I don't knock this because there are many faithful ladies who are doing this, but it's more than simply watching the babies while the men do the work, right? Isn't that what Jesus is exalting the women to do? And I'm not saying women shouldn't do those things, but I'm saying men can participate in that as well. We want to uphold and lift up our women. We want godly women. We want strong women. We want women that can sort of push back on us and provide for us and teach us and show us another aspect of who God is that we might not otherwise see. Right? Now, I come to you with that position from a full-on, like, I believe there are distinctions in roles, but I want to make sure I'm saying more clearly that both men and women are created equally in God's image, equal and distinct in roles. Make sense? That's what's happened. The other thing that's happened is as the mission has expanded, people respond to Jesus in all sorts of ways. He's gaining more popularity. He just had his first meal with one of the religious leaders. He's encountered them publicly, but one invited him into his home, and he taught this lesson about forgiveness and praise. And then the mission gets larger, and people have mixed response. Some respond in fear. Who is this? And they ask him to kind of stay away. Some respond with excitement, like this is the one we've been waiting for. Some receive him, and some reject him. And so Jesus is going to have the same response in here this morning that he's always had, right? And our hope is, for those of you that are new, is that your response would be exciting reception. That's why we do ministry. And so as that expands, Jesus gets to a point where he decides, I'm going to take the 12, that are like faithful disciples. We met them a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to send them out. And they're going to go around, they're going to declare, they're going to proclaim, they're going to preach about the kingdom of heaven, and they're going to heal diseases. So Jesus sends his 12 out on this voyage of service to people. And they go out, and they depend on God to provide for them through his people. So they're not allowed to take extra resources. They're supposed to go out, and they're just depending on God's people to be a blessing to them. And that's sort of the setting for what we're going to look at in Luke chapter 9. The disciples, the apostles he calls them at this stage, and I'll explain why in just a moment, are coming back from this voyage. And that's where I'm going to pick it up in Luke chapter 9 and verse 10. Luke 9 verse 10. On their return, the apostles told him all that they had done. And he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. When the crowds learned it, they followed him. And he welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God and cured those who had need of healing. Now the day began to wear away, and the 12 came and said to him, "Send the crowd away to go into the surrounding villages and countryside to find lodging and get provisions, for we are here in a desolate place." But he said to them, "You give them something to eat." They said, "We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we are to go and buy food for all these people." Let me stop there and start to showcase a few of the things that we're seeing in the text so far. This text this morning is somewhat difficult for me to preach. I didn't think it would be quite as difficult, but what we've done is we have started something that I'm calling Preaching Labs. And Preaching Labs is basically 7 of the guys in our church that I'm just trying to pour into to show them, here's how you study, here's how you put together a sermon, here's how you deliver it. And so I listened on Tuesday to 6 of those men deliver their sermons, and they had all kinds of food for thought. And so I had to like spend the majority of the week sifting through like, okay, what if this was really good? What do I want to steal and call my own? Because nobody will hear this, but they'll hear me. And so, right, and you say Mark Twain, he's the guy that gave up this famous quote that said, "The secret to great creativity is to hide your sources," right? So my sources are out there. I went a different track than most of them did, but it made it difficult because I had to pare down and think through, okay, how do I give this a creative spin? How do I feed the souls of the men who have already studied and delivered and preached this sermon already? And so I've got to do that at least 2 other times this summer, but this is time number 1. So that's what I'm dealing with. I hope my thoughts are not too scattered for you, but here's what's going on. These apostles, they've been sent out. Now they're coming back to Jesus. Now they're called apostles because they have been sent out. These are the 12 disciples who were sent out. That's what apostle means. It means sent one. They were sent out to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal. And so they're called apostles because they've been sent out. Now when they return, they gave Jesus a very detailed account of everything that they had done. And I suspect that there was great excitement in them returning home, getting ready to share with Jesus all the things that they had just experienced. Right? And I know a little bit of something of this because one of the things that we value in our home is we value mealtime. Right? If I have meetings in the evening, I try to still make it home, have dinner. It's the one meal that I can have with the whole family. And what we do around the table is we share what's happened in our day. Right? What's happened at school, what's happened since school got out, and the kids are usually like wet your pants excited to share with daddy the things that they've encountered for the day. And that's one of my great joys. I get to sit there and listen to, hey, what's happened today? And they start telling me all the stories of what's happened. And here's the thing. I really appreciate my son, Ashton. He's my 9-year-old. And what Ashton wants, he's a peacekeeper. But he wants everybody to feel like they're a part of the conversation. And so what he'll do is he will translate the details of the stories that I'm getting from my other son and daughter. And sometimes he's translating for Bracken, even though Bracken's just like, you know, randomly screaming. But Ashton is trying to explain the details, and you need that because I've got a 5-year-old daughter, and she loves to give all of the details, even though I might be completely lost in the story. Like, I'm sitting there listening, I'm like, what? Was there a unicorn involved? And how did that get into your closet? And so Ashton is there, and he's trying to explain some of the details, whether it is right or not. And so very quickly, often the conversation, maybe you've seen this, maybe you've experienced, maybe you've participated in this, but the conversation goes from like getting the details of the day to this very sophisticated back and forth where when the detail is incorrect, one of the children steps up and they say, "Nuh-uh," right? Have you heard that word? I don't even know how to spell that word, but it's a word and it's used very often, right? And then what's the response to "nuh-uh"? "Yes, huh," right? And it's about "nuh-uh," "yes, huh." It's this back and forth and there's excitement. And so maybe the disciples are going through the same thing, right? They're coming back and they're telling Jesus, "Here's what's happened." And others are, "Hey, let me piggyback on that story and let me tell you some things." And one of the, you know, James looks over at John, he's like, "Nuh-uh." And John's like, "Well, I was there." "Yes, huh," right? And so Jesus sees this happening, and what does he decide to do? Hey disciples, let's get out of the public's eye right now, right? That's because you don't want to do this, and you don't want this bantering of "nuh-uh," "yes, huh," back and forth. I don't know if that's exactly what happened, but if it's anything like my home, that's probably what Jesus is doing. Like, let's go away. Let's talk about this. Or maybe he's taking them away to let the reality of what they've just done sink in. And so he takes them away to this town called Bethsaida. And what ends up happening is as the crowds hear it, they start to follow. The crowds are aware that Jesus and the disciples are withdrawing, and so they follow Jesus and his disciples. They're like, there he goes. Let's go after him. They're bantering. They're bickering. Maybe they're speaking in unknown languages. I don't know. Let's go. Let's follow him. And then Luke uses a word that's only used in Luke's account. And it says that Jesus welcomed the crowds. Now, we can't really get into the nitty-gritty of what that means and what that looks like, because the only time we have this word welcome, it's here in the Gospel of Luke. Now, let me throw you a little literary lesson, okay? Some of you English people and some of you literature people, you're going to know what this means, and you might have better examples, better illustrations. But the word, when it's only used in one context, do you know what that's called? It's called a hapax legomenon, right? You like that? Hapax legomenon. It means a word is used only in a particular context. So there are some hapax legomena, that's the plural, right? Latin here. There are some that are only used maybe in the New Testament. There are some that are maybe only Paul's words. But then there are some that are worked in other works of literature and things like that. In fact, William Shakespeare has a play, a drama called Love's Labor Lost. He uses a hapax legomenon that I attempted in the 9 o'clock to pronounce, and I'm just going to spare you the attempt. I won't even try to pronounce it, but he has one. So Google is a very popular search engine. Look it up. Just hapax legomenon, William Shakespeare. You'll see the word. And there are bonus points to get into heaven if you can pronounce it, I think. Because I still can't do it. I've been trying all week, okay? So now this particular word that Jesus is using, or that Luke is using for Jesus welcoming him, it's only used here in Luke's account. And so we don't know, like, what that looked like, but we know it was encouraging because when Jesus welcomed the people, they stuck around. And they continue to stick around. And they stick around as the day wears on. The day begins to wear away. And why is it wearing away? Because here's what Jesus is doing. He's going around in the crowds and he's speaking to them about the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's interesting that it says that he's speaking. It doesn't say he's proclaiming. He's not teaching. He's having conversations. He's doing everyday life with this crowd of people. He's talking to them about maybe the things that they've seen and experienced regarding the kingdom of heaven. And then he's curing anybody that needs therapy. Right? You need help. You need to understand physically what the kingdom of God looks like. Boom, you're cured. Jesus is doing that. Oh, you need emotional help? Boom, you're cured. So Jesus is going around. He's having conversations. What's going on? How are you learning? Oh, let me help you with that. And he does this all day. And so no wonder the people aren't leaving, right? It's a great, like, backyard event. They're in this town, Bethsaida. They're all hanging out with Jesus, and they're being cured, and they're understanding things about the kingdom that they'd never understood before. And what happens? The sent ones decide it's time to send these folks away. Now maybe they're agitated. We don't know. Maybe they're trying to be merciful because they recognize that these folks, they need to eat, and they need a place to stay. Now, it's interesting that they need a place to stay, because that means that these folks weren't coming from a short distance. That they're probably coming from all the towns and the villages that the disciples have just spent all of their time depending on them to have their needs met. Now the crowds are coming to the disciples, and so maybe this retreat was an opportunity to let the reality of Jesus teaching his disciples that they're to be dependent upon him through his people. They're going to see the flip side of that. And so they need these provisions. These are very likely the people the apostles had been preaching to and healing, and Jesus involves the 12 in meeting their needs. Right, let's send them away. Jesus says, no, don't do that. You'll miss the point of the lesson. Don't send them away. You get involved in giving them something to eat. And so they look around and they realize we're in a desolate place. We don't have resources, right? Maybe Barnabas over here, he can like hunt bear, but there aren't any bear around to be hunted. So what are we going to do? They say all we have is 5 loaves and 2 fish. That's not even enough to feed us because we're hungry and this is all we've got. How can we do that? So they look at their own resources and they realize that they don't have enough. And then they start, well, maybe we could buy food. Maybe we could, this is a church gathering. We're talking about Jesus and we're talking about healing, so let's take up an offering. Maybe we can go into town and buy something to eat. The thing that I find that's fascinating is what they fail to consider, they fail to ask Jesus to meet the need, don't they? That they look at themselves, they look at what resources do we have, what resources could we pull together, and they have the greatest resource of all right there with them, and that's Jesus. And they don't ask him to meet their needs. And so what Jesus does is he's about to use eating and drinking to teach us our interdependence on him and on one another. The disciples had been shown provision by the crowds, which received them. Now they're to reciprocate by showing them God's provision. And they don't fully understand how they're going to do this. But we are very much like the disciples in this story, aren't we? We look at our resources, we look at what we have, and we fail to consider asking Jesus to help us to become a people who are interdependent. Right? And I've got the notes flipped. I'm going to flip the way that I presented this in the first gathering, and I'm going to flip the way that I presented it in the notes. So let's bring up both points that we have. Some of us overemphasize. The first one is dependence. I'm going to come back to that. But I want to emphasize, first of all, some of us overemphasize our independence. We're very good. We're very skilled at looking at the resources that we have. We're very good at looking at, all right, who's here? How could we gather our resources and take care of the needs in a way that excludes our need for Jesus? Some of us do that, and we overemphasize our independence. Are we independent to some extent? Yeah, sure we are. And what I mean by that is there are responsibilities that we should take for ourselves. But what many of us do, particularly in our culture, is we believe about ourselves that we are completely independent of everybody around us, that we never look to Jesus and what he's done to bring us to where we are, that we don't look at the people that are around us that have made us who we are. We think that we are very self-made men and women. And so that sets up a sort of a sense of arrogance, and it pushes us away from people. What we end up doing is we either fail or we refuse to acknowledge the work that others have done to allow us to be where we are. And I look around at Missio and I'm like, if I do this, I'm the most pompous type of man, but I see it happen all the time. God showed up to me in Asheville, North Carolina several years back. And he declared to me, I want you to leave this and I want you to go back to your hometown and I want you to start over. And so here's what I could do, because we're going to be, in this fall, we'll be celebrating our second birthday as a church. And I anticipate that by Thanksgiving, Christmas time, we'll be a church that didn't exist 2 years ago of maybe 300 plus people. And so what I can do is I can look at that and say, man, I did amazing work. I was faithful. I was obedient. I heeded the call of God. I am amazing. Look at what I've done. And fail to recognize the sacrifice of the people who have made this happen. And fail to recognize the fact that it's only because the hand of God has been upon us that we're seeing the life transformation and the growth that we're experiencing. But I see this happen among pastors all the time. We get up here and we say a few things, we have a few gifts, and then we're like, the reason that this is happening is because I'm obedient, I know how to bring it, and I'm doing all these things right, and we either fail or refuse to acknowledge that that's not why it's happening. If God hadn't providentially brought Pastor Justin into my life at the season that he did, at that appointed time, this would not work. Right? And it would not work if God had not brought the men and the women who have been a part of this since day one, and many of whom are still walking with, if they didn't commit, if they didn't sacrifice their lives to continue to walk this out, we would not be what we are. I wouldn't be able to hear the stories of what's going on, either struggle or victory in our mission groups, if it weren't for the people that are being involved. I mean, I listen to stories all the time, and I have no influence other than Sunday morning saying a few things to people to see their life transformation take place. I cannot possibly take credit for that, but we do, don't we? We fail to recognize the circumstances, the providence of God, the commitment of other people, and that leads us to isolation. So that's one way that we sort of push away our interdependence on God and his people. The other way is we overemphasize our dependence on people. And I know you've already seen it, so there's no big surprise there. But here's what I mean by that. What we end up doing is taking very little responsibility. And I could get up here and be very falsely humble and say, oh, we're only here because of other people, right? And I think that's okay. I think there could be a sense of false humility in that. I hope that's certainly not coming out of my heart. But the other reaction to this is that we bear no responsibility in the things that are happening to us or the things that have happened to us. And so we start to share everything with everybody, looking for somebody to just speak into what is going on into our lives, taking no responsibility for ourselves. And so we get these burdens, and rather than carrying any of the weight, we just drop them off in somebody else's lap. We take no responsibility for ourselves, and we become a burden to others and give them responsibility that we should be carrying ourselves. Now, the gospel picture is interdependence. We belong to one another, right? But we've all seen this, right? You've been a part of groups, maybe at work, maybe in your neighborhood, where somebody else's drama all of a sudden becomes your drama, and you seem to be more bothered by it than they are. Have you met those folks? Some of you are those folks, right? You may not realize, but we're constantly sharing our burdens with whoever would listen to us, and we're bearing no responsibility. We fail to take any responsibility for ourselves. We hurl that responsibility on others. And what does it do? Just like overemphasis on independence, it leads us into isolation. We're isolated from God because we're not seeking him to meet some of our needs. We're isolated from people because people can only handle so much. And when we're sharing things with them that they're not equipped to handle, they back off. And then we start to blame them, and it creates a big mess. And then we're completely isolated from God's purposes because we have loose affiliation and loose connection, and we don't express a lot of interdependence. And I think the 12 are in a place where they're like, I don't want that. I know that I emphasize either dependence or independence, and what we want is interdependence. And so here's what they do. Verse 14. There were about 5,000 men. That's an enormous difficulty, isn't it? That's quite a large burden. 5,000 men. Other gospel accounts say that there were women and children as well. And he says to his disciples, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. And they did so and had them all sit down. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing over them. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the crowd. And they all ate and were satisfied. And what was left over was picked up, 12 baskets of broken pieces. So Jesus performs a miracle. He performs a miracle of provision. This, outside of the resurrection, is the only miracle that's recorded in each account of Jesus' life in the Bible. So it's an important thing to learn, right? If all 4 of them are saying this was an important moment in Jesus' life, then we should pause and reflect on that. The first thing that the disciples are struck by is the enormity of the work. I mean, Jesus is saying we're supposed to be interdependent. And he's saying we're supposed to be interdependent with at least, in this story, 5,000 men plus women and children. So if that's one man, one woman, one child, you're looking at a crowd of 15,000 people, right? So you're looking at going to Great American Ballpark, and people are hanging out with Jesus and talking to him all day, and all of a sudden they need a place to eat, and they need like a place to sleep. And Jesus looks at 12 people and it says, you take care of it, all right? Take care of it. Let me give you a little help. Break it down so it's not overwhelming. Break them down into groups of 50 and do that, right? And that's one of the methods that we try to embrace at Missio. We want to see the city saturated with Bible-believing, gospel-embracing, Jesus-following men and women and children and families. That's what we want to see. Well, there's a lot of people, right? 2.1 million in the metro area. That's a lot of mouths, proverbially speaking, to feed. And so Jesus says, okay, break it down. Break them down to 50. So and this is our method. As we grow larger, we want to grow smaller. If you need a place to connect for interdependence, that's why we have mission groups. We want you to have people that lock arms with you and carry the burdens with you and sort of challenge you when you're putting too much of a burden on them or when you're thinking too independently. That's what this is supposed to do. It's an enormous work. But as we do that, they set the stage. The disciples set the stage for Jesus to do his thing, right? That's what they're doing. They're sitting them down. They have the crowd sit down. It was probably a great amount of work. And what I love about this is they don't know what Jesus is going to do, right? How is he going to feed all of these people? He hasn't declared that to them yet. And so I love that they're sort of like very actively obedient, even though they don't understand everything that they're doing. Right? And some of us this morning, like, we're new to the faith. Christianity is kind of a new thing, and you're being asked to do things, and you're like, I don't really understand the fullness of what I'm doing. And you're obeying anyway. And that's a great sign. It's like, I don't understand why I'm doing it, but I'm doing it. And maybe Jesus will do something with this, right? Obedience, even without the fullness of understanding. We see this. I know we've talked about baby dedication, baptism. One of the things that we're looking for is confession of faith, even if it's as basic as what a 9-year-old can give you. And that's why I had the privilege of baptizing my son at Easter. But I don't expect him to understand everything that he walks out in obedience to Jesus. That's unrealistic, right? I was baptized when I was 19, so I was like a half-grown man, right? Some of you would say, you're still a half-grown man. Touche, right? Or as my daughter, Rain, would say, bouche. She says it with a lot more sass than that. But I was an adult. I understood what I was getting into, but I can tell you, man, now that I've been walking this out for many, 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 many years, I understand it so much better than I did when I walked through it. It's not about how well you understand. It's about like being obedient with what you do understand. And the disciples do that. And they set the stage. When we do that, we set a stage for Jesus to do his thing. And so here's what Jesus does. He looks to heaven, he blesses, and he breaks. And then Jesus keeps giving the loaves to the disciples. He takes it, he gives thanks to God. So we see in that a picture of Jesus' dependence on the Father. Jesus will not act independently of the Father. Why? Because Jesus understands interdependence, and he's trying to demonstrate for us, hey, I am dependent on another. I am dependent on the Father, and you need to see that picture. The perfect man, the perfect God, united in one person, is dependent upon another. So it's not a sign of weakness. So we can express a little bit of dependence. But then, and we miss this in the English version, if you have an old New American Standard version, one of those like hardline, literal, word-for-word translations, it doesn't say that he took, looked, blessed, and broke, and then it might say, your English version that we're looking at says, and he gave. But in the original language, there's this idea that when he gave, he kept giving. He kept giving. The disciples had to return to him, and he kept giving. And every time they returned to him, he gave them something to give out as a blessing to others. And so Jesus uses his people to serve his people, and he equips them with what they need to do it. And sometimes it's supernatural. As long as you keep coming back to Jesus, he gives you something to give to people. And what I love about this is that Jesus does not operate in a pie in the sky, separate, distinct, right? We get in these arguments about whether or not Jesus has established everything that will ever happen and he's off in la-la land, disconnected from the world. That's a bad view of how God operates in the world. Jesus is showing us, no, there's an interaction. He's personally involved in every person. Every one of us, Jesus is actively involved because God uses his people to reach his people. He doesn't not use his people to reach his people. So God isn't up in heaven just making things happen, like waving his hands over the world and hoping something will happen. He uses people to get it done. Can he like speak and do those things? Yes, but typically he does not. But a lot of us have this distant mindset about God being disconnected and isolated from his people. And we miss a lot of what God is up to because we miss of how he gets these things to us through his people. And then what's the result? As God works through his people who set the stage for him to do his thing, there's satisfaction and abundance, isn't it? They all ate. They were all satisfied. The crowds, the disciples, the women who aren't even named in this story but had been following Jesus, Jesus himself, they're all satisfied. And then what's the end of the story? 12 baskets left over. Why? Because there were 12 men who weren't sure how Jesus was going to provide for all these people. They started looking at their own resources instead of looking at Jesus. At the end of the day, Jesus says, yeah, when you look to my resources, there's enough left over for those of you who continue to doubt. Because God, when he comes through, he provides with satisfaction and abundance. And that's really good news for us, isn't it? He creates in us an interdependence, showing us that Jesus was, one, dependent, right? He's giving thanks, and two, depended upon, multiplying the bread. And then he provides abundant satisfaction, and he does it through his sent ones. And because Jesus does this, and because Jesus reunites us to the purpose of creation, which is that we would be an interdependent people, and because he went to the cross, and because he overcomes the things that separate us, mainly overemphasizing our dependence or independence, he gives us the Spirit to empower us for interdependence. And what does that look like? I'm going to give you two things, and then I'll give you an opportunity to respond. First thing we do, if we are a people that believe this, if we are walking by faith, we will walk out interdependence by bearing one another's burdens. We will bear one another's burdens to walk this out. If we have the Spirit of God, this should be a staple of your life. The way this looks, number one, is we will express a dependence upon God and upon his people. You will come around the community of the faithful, and you will share your burdens, and you will say, I can't carry this alone. And you'll have a group and a community of people that will come alongside of you, and they'll say, I know you can't. Let me carry it with you. And sometimes you're going to thrust a little too much of your burden on somebody else. And there's grace for that. And there's forgiveness. And we're going to mess up. And sometimes we're not going to share enough of the burden. And it's going to come out later, probably explosively, feeling like nobody is genuinely interested in what you're doing. And there's going to be grace for that as well. But we've got to start somewhere. And we want to be a community that expresses interdependence. Dependence on God, dependence on his people, provision for those around us. Here's the way this should look. We should take on the suffering of the burdens of those around us. Listen to what probably the most famous, most thoughtful North American theologian said about this. His name is Jonathan Edwards. He was around in the 1600s in New England, saw this great revival of God. He wrote this. He said, if we be never obliged to relieve others' burdens, but when we can do it without burdening ourselves, then how do we bear our neighbor's burdens when we bear no burden at all? Here's what Edwards is saying, right? Because that can get a little confusing. It's old English. Here's what he's saying. You're not bearing somebody's burden if it doesn't cost you something. If you're not entering into the suffering with somebody, you're not really carrying the burden for them. And we want to create communities where we enter into that. We don't run from it. The easy thing is to run, to say, hey, man, you're on your own. But as a community of the faithful, Jesus is teaching us, right? He's just taught the disciples how he would provide for them as they're out there on their journey. He will put people in place to meet their needs, and now the people are coming back. And if they don't step in and provide, then there's going to be 5,000 plus people that go hungry. And Jesus said, no, my people take care of one another. And you know what? It's exhausting, and it's going to take a lot of work. You think it's easy to move people, 5,000 people around, right? They've been sitting in the sun all day. Right? Jordan Boyd was preaching about this. He said, we're like the guy that maybe drank a little too much the night before, and now he's out in the sun, and you're telling him, I can't have you with this group. I need you to go over there. It's difficult, right? And it's a lot of work. But that's what we're supposed to look like. And if Jesus is alive in us, we do it gladly. We can't say that we're interdependent if we're not bearing the burdens of one another. But how do we do that? Second thing we need to do, we need to steward our interdependence well. We need to steward this well because it's hard work, because it takes a lot out of us, because it's such a glorious thing. We need to steward it well, which means we need to take appropriate responsibility for ourselves so that we're not creating an unnecessary burden for the people around us. So we need to evaluate, okay, I'm wrestling with something. Is this something I need to just completely drop? Do I need to let it go? Do I need to share it with somebody else? How much should I share with somebody else? What responsibility do I take on this? Instead of, well, I want this to go away, so I'm just going to vomit all over somebody verbally. But we need to take responsibility for ourselves so that we're not creating unnecessary burdens for others. I'm going to hit this quickly and then move on as quickly as I can. But men, many of you are young. And some of us we're playing games with parents, with girls, with jobs. We refuse to take responsibility for ourselves, and we're always looking for somebody to come in and bail us out, aren't we? Moving back home, counting on a lady to get a better job, to be one of these, like, what about the ladies in the Gospel of Luke that are making provision? Can I be that guy? Yeah, not if you are putting unnecessary burdens on other people. Step up and take responsibility for yourself. If you call yourself a child of God, do that. You've got the ability to do it. You've got the Spirit of God living in you. I said I'd hit it quick. I'm going to move right by it, okay? Here's how we do this. Some of you are like, I don't know where to start. What is Jesus doing? He's continually giving to the disciples as they return to him. Here's the lesson we learned from that. You can only distribute what you've received. If you haven't gone to Jesus, if you haven't gotten that like filled up in your heart, you've got nothing to give to people. And you will just be a continual burden on others and take no responsibility. So step one in taking responsibility, go to Jesus. Get something from him that you can distribute to others because you can only distribute what you've received. Second thing, the second truth in that is that Jesus is the source to whom we must continually return. If you want something to offer, you've got to get it from the one who has something to offer, namely Jesus. So Jesus is the source of life and strength and responsibility and taking it on the chin for his neighbor. That's where we continue to go. Jesus performs the miracle, but he distributes the blessing through his disciples, and it's work. And some of us are still sitting in our seats and we're like, wait a second, I thought this was a Reformed church where we believe that Jesus has done the work and there's nothing left for us to do. And you just kind of sniff that out, like any sort of performance, you sniff that out and you're like, I'm running from this place. But be careful, because here's what Paul tells us in Ephesians. And I'll say it this way, we're not saved by our work, right? God is not impressed with what we do for him, but we are saved to work. That's what Ephesians says. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God has prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And so don't let your desire to sniff out this idea that people are justified by their work prevent you from doing anything. It takes work. You're saved to do work. Now you're free to do things, not so that God would be pleased with you, but so that you can show how pleased he is with you in his Son. And it changes the whole nature of that. And so there is something to do. Work is messy, right? It's difficult. It absolutely is dreadful. Some of the phone calls I've had in the past 3 weeks that some of you guys are going through. And I love you, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. I'm getting ready to go on a retreat to just kind of get refreshed and connect back to the source. It sucks going to the hospital to meet with an 8-year-old who should not be there. It's terrible listening to the marriages that are falling apart, but I wouldn't trade it for the world, because in the end, there's abundance in satisfaction and joy, and that's the life that God has created us to live. The Father has created us for interdependence. We belong to one another. God the Son was both dependent and depended upon, and God the Spirit empowers us to express interdependence with satisfaction and abundance. I want to create an environment for you to be able to respond. Some of you will just need to just pray, Lord, which one am I? We'll give an opportunity this week, too, to process that with your mission group. But maybe you need somebody to help bear that burden. Grab somebody that you trust. Let them pray with you. There'll be a couple folks in the back. They would love and be honored to pray with you. Grab me after the gathering. I'll pray with you. That's one of the joys of my life and ministry. And after you've prayed and after you've reflected, we want to invite you up to the table. We want you to take a taste of the one who is dependent and dependent upon. And so you can receive community. If you want somebody to help bear that burden with you, grab somebody. Grab somebody that you trust. Let them serve communion to you. If you, I do need to say this, if you have an aversion to wine, we do have grape juice in the bowls. If you have any dietary restrictions to regular bread, we have gluten-free bread in the bowls that are white as well. We want to invite as many folks forward as we possibly can to participate in communion, bearing burdens together. And then we want us ourselves to bear the burden of singing praise to one another. And so we'll give you an opportunity to sing more songs of praise, lifting one another up, hopefully celebrating the goodness that Jesus has restored our godly interdependence. Let me pray for you and give you an opportunity to respond. Father, thank you for not just the example of Jesus, but also the victory of Christ. That we don't express interdependence to be accepted by you, but because we are, we just walk it out. And may this be a time of reminder for many of us that we need to tap into the source so that we have something to distribute. And Father God, I pray that we would be able to walk this out with abundance of joy and satisfaction for the glory of your name and the joy of the people around us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, amen.